Zechariah chapter 3. And we'll read verses 1 and 2. And he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And the Lord said unto Satan, The Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? There's very likely a Christian here this evening who has fallen into sin, serious sin, and who has been chastised or is being chastised for that sin, and who feels very filthy, maybe forgotten, exiled from God's presence, maybe hearing multiple accusations coming into the conscience and the mind and the heart from the wicked one, and probably feeling helpless and hopeless. And if that's not you, then it may well be you at some point in the future. I hope not, but it's possible that one or more Christians here will fall into serious sin and will be seriously chastised, feel separated from God, feel just disgusted with themselves, and have no shortage of accusations. Well, for both, I want to turn you to Zechariah chapter 3 this evening, because this chapter tells us this: through Christ, God graciously restores his fallen and chastised people. And he restores them to beauty, to his love, and to usefulness. Through Christ, God graciously restores his chastened people to usefulness, to his love, and to beauty. That's what we'd like to look at this evening. It's a book probably you're not very familiar with, not many of us are. And maybe just a bit of background history would help to understand this chapter a bit better. As some of you will know, God's chosen people, Israel or Judah, latterly, were sent into Babylonian exile for their sins. And they stayed there for 70 years before they were restored by another heathen king, Cyrus, who rose up and sent them back to their land. And the last three books of the Bible, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, are all about that period of time of when the people were restored to the land, but to very difficult times. And many of their hopes were dashed. Things did not work out as they wished, at least as fast as they wanted. And indeed, many of them eventually sank into fairly deep discouragement and depression as they pondered the shattered land, the destroyed city of Jerusalem, the temple in ruins, as they saw all that their sins had brought upon themselves and their land. And into this come Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi with great promises and challenges. In Zechariah's early chapters, chapters 1 and 2, set forth three visions which tell us about Israel's external deliverance from Babylon, its expansion, and its material prosperity. That's to encourage the people that better times are ahead materially, nationally. But this vision here, the fourth vision in chapter 3, is much more spiritual. It's much more to do with spiritual restoration. And it's set forth using the example of Joshua, who we'll see stands for Israel's restoration to God's love, to beauty and usefulness. We'd like to look at really the three main figures in this chapter. First of all, we'd like to look at a filthy Joshua. Then we'd like to look secondly at a fighting Satan. And thirdly, we'd like to look at a forgiving God. But first of all, here we have a filthy Joshua. We read, "And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him." I want to tell you six things about Joshua. First of all, he is a representative. You'll notice he's called the high priest. The high priest was to stand in the place of the whole nation before God. He was to represent Israel before God in prayer, and also to sacrifice for them, sort of one standing for the many. And that's how he's viewed here. This is not about Joshua as an individual. This is about Joshua as a representative of the nation. And so when we're reading about Joshua, we're reading about Israel. We're reading about God's people. He is a picture. He is a figure. He's a symbol for the whole people of God. He's singled out here so that Israel and the rest of God's people can look at him and learn from him about themselves. That's the first thing. He's a representative. Secondly, he is shocking. He's shocking. It says here, "He showed me Joshua," but it's literally, "He caused me to gaze upon Joshua." And it almost suggests, I think it does suggest, a reluctance to look upon Joshua. Zechariah is saying, God made me look. He made me gaze. He made me study Joshua. And as we go on and look at him, I think we'll understand why there was this reluctance, why there was this hesitation, why he had to be forced to look. Because what we're about to see is indeed a shocking sight, especially for the high priest. Thirdly here, he is waiting. Notice it says he's standing before the angel of the Lord. Now this, some people think, is a court scene. So he's sort of standing in court, waiting to be accused, or waiting for sentence to be pronounced. But I don't believe that is the context here. The context is not so much a court, but a palace. It's not so much about crimes and punishment, but about service of the king. And so here, Joshua is standing, as it were, waiting to serve, waiting for orders. He's not moving. He's not rushing up and saying, okay, what do you want me to do? What will I do next? No, he's standing. And he's standing before the angel of the Lord. Now, you may remember we've looked at a number of Old Testament passages that focus on this person of the angel or the messenger of the Lord, and we've seen that this is the Son of God before he came to earth in human form. So here we have the second person of the Trinity. Joshua is standing before him and he's waiting. And again, I think as we go on, we'll understand why he's waiting. He's not rushing forward, offering himself for service, because here's the fourth thing about him: he's filthy. He's standing in the royal court in front of the royal king. He's supposed to be engaged in royal service, and yet look at him. He is disgusting. the garments here are such a contrast to what should be. In the Old Testament, earlier on in the book of Exodus and chapter 28, in fact, there are a number of chapters in the Old Testament devoted to describing the priest's garments. In chapter 28, for example, verse 2, it says, "You shall make holy garments for Aaron, thy brother," the high priest, "for glory and for beauty." This was the great aim of the high priest's garments. They were to be glorious and they were to be beautiful. And when you go on to read, you go home and read chapter 28, you read just verse after verse. How long does it go on for? 43 verses of description. And it's not the only chapter about all the colors, the materials, the precious stones. It's really quite remarkable. In verse 36, "Thou shalt make a plate of pure gold and grave upon it, like the engravings of a signet, holiness to the Lord." You see, this high priest was to be beautiful and glorious. He was to have an aura, an awe, a presence about him. He was to stand there, not just representing the people to God, but God to the people as well. But what do we find? We find here, verse 3, he's clothed with filthy garments. The word for filthy here is used elsewhere for human waste. It's really a disgusting picture. It's almost obscene. You can't imagine a worse scene than this. Here is somebody, they've got these beautiful robes, and yet they're covered in waste. They're covered in filth. And then we're told, fifthly, he's chastised. In verse 2, "Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire?" And again, remember, Joshua is representing Israel, and basically God is saying is that Israel, for their sins, have been in the fire. This was quite a common image for chastisement in the Old Testament. You remember Job used it himself when he was speaking of the trial he was going through. "When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold." Well, here, Joshua, standing for the whole nation of Israel, he's described as a brand plucked from the fire. This is Joshua. The whole nation have been in God's fire of chastisement. He's been torching them, you might say. He's been flaming them, but not incinerating them. They are singed, and they are scarred, and they have burn marks, and they have ash on them. They've clearly been in the fire, but they've also been plucked out before turned to just ash and dust. They're still recognizable. And here the angel of the Lord looks at Joshua and says, "Is not this a brand plucked from the fire?" Here's Israel. They have been in God's furnace of affliction. But God all the time had his hand on the thermometer and the thermostat, knowing how hot and how long to keep them there. And then when he pleased, he plucked them out, though they deserved to be turned to ash. He plucked them out. And you feel as if he's saying this, "Is not this a brand plucked from the fire," with a measure of holy pride, with a sense of achievement of what he has done. He's saying, "Look, is not this a brand plucked from the fire? Look what I've done." He's not ashamed of this. And notice sixthly about Joshua, he's silent. He doesn't say a word. He's got nothing to say. Because of his sins, because he's been chastised. because, as we'll see, many other things are coming into his ears. Filthy Joshua is not just a picture, though, of filthy Israel. He's a picture of filthy Christians. Christians become like Joshua at times. Like Joshua, we can be shocking, horrific to look at. Like Joshua, we stand there, helpless, lame, unable to move, knowing we should be servants, but unable to serve. Like Joshua, we are filthy. We feel it, we sense it, we smell it, we're disgusted with ourselves. Like Joshua, we are chastised. We're still here, we haven't been turned to ash, but we can smell the singeing, can't we? We can feel acutely the burning. Though God has rescued us and spared us incineration, yet we are very tender and we're silent, we have nothing to say. Well, that's a bad enough situation to be in, but it gets worse because a second figure is introduced to us here, a fighting Satan. Notice it says, he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord and Satan, meaning adversary, standing at his right hand to resist him. Six things about this devil as well. First, he's opposing, standing at his right hand to resist him. This is a poor, pathetic figure of a person, of a nation. He's hardly able to stand or speak. And then the devil piles in as well, standing at his right hand to resist him. This is his great aim, his great intention, is to oppose and to fight. He is, by nature and name, the adversary, the devil, the enemy of our souls. And notice he too is standing. But what kind of standing? It's not like Joshua's standing, a kind of paralysis. No, his standing is a crouch. He's ready to pounce. He's just waiting to attack. He's sort of on tiptoes, you sense, ready to go for the kill. And he too is waiting. But it's interesting that his kind of waiting too is different to Joshua's. It's very clear from this passage that the devil, Satan, is not the one in control. That he is subject to the angel of the Lord. He's the master of ceremonies over this. And Joshua and the devil wait his bidding. Nothing happens in this scene without the permission of the angel of God, the Son of God. So the devil's waiting is a reluctant waiting that indicates his subordinate, subservient position. But his great aim is prosecuting. He's come to prosecute him. This is what really resist him means. He's come to accuse. The Lord, we read, says to Satan in verse 2, "The Lord rebuke thee, O Satan." And here clearly the devil is wanting to speak. He's got no end of accusations waiting to throw out, and here God stops him, as we'll see, but he's come armed, he's equipped to prosecute this poor, fallen, chastised Christian. He's come to stick the knife in and twist it. And it's a very easy thing to do to a fallen Christian, isn't it? To a backslidden Christian, to one, if we fall into temptation, it's just open season for the devil, isn't it? He comes with his briefcase full of charges and starts reading them out, yelling them out, screaming them out, driving them in. What kind of Christian do you think you are? Look at you. You've done it again. Didn't I say this is what would happen? Look at you. You said you were a Christian. You even did this Christian service. Maybe you even preached. Maybe you've gone and served the Lord in different places, and now look at you. You should never have opened your mouth. You're a poor specimen of a believer. Call yourself holy. Call yourself a Christian. Look how weak you are. Look how easy it was for me. Look at you in your filth. You're stinking. You're wretched. You're disgusting to God, to yourself, to everyone. We've heard them, haven't we? He's described in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 10. With these words, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. Well, that's a future scene. Cast down, but at present, many of us know this day and night prosecution, don't we? This long trial, not just day long, not just week long, not just month long, but maybe years long. The case continues to build against us as he expertly brings his charges. He is prosecuting. And he's intimidating. Notice, there's not a word from Joshua again. Here he is, Satan's come with all these charges. Not a word from Joshua. What can he say? What defense does he have? He's intimidated. He's silenced. He's threatened by the ferocity and the truthfulness, in many cases, of the accuser's accusations. But notice, sixthly, he's losing. Yes, the devil is opposing, he's standing, he's waiting, he's prosecuting, he's intimidating, but he's also losing. However fierce and ferocious, yet he's losing this battle. He's losing this case. Because here we read of a forgiving God. Thirdly, the forgiving God. The angel of the Lord is speaking here. In verse 2, the Lord said unto Satan, the Lord rebuke thee, O Satan. We'd like to look at how God drives back the devil and how he builds up Joshua here. What arguments does he use? Well, first of all, he says, I've chosen him. Notice, the Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, verse 2, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. That phrase, the Lord has chosen Jerusalem. It's not Jerusalem chose the Lord. Neither is it he chose Jerusalem because they were better, because of any merit, because of anything attractive. It just doesn't say that. It just says God chose Jerusalem. Out of all the cities, out of all the peoples, God chose Jerusalem. God chose Israel. This is a wonderful argument to use back against the devil. Election. An election that's not based upon anything we are or anything we've done or anything we will be or do, but simply God's choice. We don't go back to the devil and say, well, don't you know who I am and don't you know what I've done? No, we go back to the devil and say, don't you know who God is and don't you know what he's done? He's the God of unconditional election. He's the God who chooses because he chooses, not because of anything in me. That's the Lord's first argument here. I've chosen him. Secondly, he says, I'm protecting him. The Lord rebuke thee, O Satan. Even the Lord that's chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Here we have the adversary, for sure. But we also have the advocate coming against him and saying, I rebuke you. Now, there's rebuke and there's rebuke. If I was to come to one of you, and maybe you were saying terrible things to somebody, or about somebody, and I would say, the Lord rebuke you, well, you might be a wee bit startled, but you'd probably just continue going. Who are you? We can go out into the world and try this, maybe, if you like. You go and try it. Say to somebody who's swearing or taking God's name in vain, and you say, the Lord rebuke you. Well, they might stop for a minute or two, but it won't stop for very long. There's not much power in our rebukes, is there? They're not very effective. Well, let's look at what kind of rebuke we're speaking of here. We see this in two places. In Psalm 106 and verse 9, we read, he rebuked the Red Sea also, and it was dried up. What a rebuke. And sometimes the devil's accusations feel like a torrential river flooding into our souls that's going to overwhelm us, and there's no way out, just as Israel felt, until God rebuked the sea and drove it back and gave them a dry path across. This is the kind of rebuke that's spoken of here. This is the kind of rebuke that you can experience in your own life when the Lord does the rebuking. And that should be our prayer. Lord, come and rebuke him. Come and do a Red Sea rebuke to this torrent of accusations that are kicking me when I'm down and won't let me even get back up an inch from the floor. As soon as I try, in it comes again. What's the point in you trying? How many times have you been on this floor? How many promises have you made? How many resolutions have you broken? You really think you're going to be different this time? What makes you so sure? Look at him and look at her. What happened to them? Why is that not going to happen to you again? If you don't fall here, you'll fall there. You're useless. You're hopeless. Give it up. Give in and get away from this. God, rebuke them. Dry them up and give me a dry path through this that I can walk upon. He rebuked the Red Sea and it was dried up. And then again in Mark chapter 4 and verse 39, and he arose and rebuked the wind and said unto the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Doesn't your little life feel like this little boat tossed around in this torrential storm, flooded, at great risk of sinking? And then one arises, rebukes the wind, and says to the sea, peace, be still. Glass calm. Not a breath of wind. That's what happens when the Lord does the rebuking. Ask Him for it. When you hear these accusations, false or true, coming from the adversary, you need an advocate. And He's around and He's available. And He's successful. Ask Him to take His dying and rising and use it to rebuke these accusations so that He can say of whatever accusation, true or false, exaggerated or bang on accurate, covered, cancelled, gone, peace, be still. Here, the Son of God is saying, I've chosen Him and I'm protecting Him. Then thirdly, He says, and I'm restoring him. I'm restoring him. He doesn't just stop the devil from kicking this poor man when he's down. He says, this is a brand plucked from the burning. You might look at this stick that's been in the fire, and you'd wonder what it was. Maybe it's been charred a bit, bits fallen off. You think, well, it may have looked good at one point, but what can that be again? But that's not how he's not saying, well, look at this poor brand. Well, we got it out the fire, but who knows what now? No, he's holding it up with that holy pride, that creative wisdom that can take the most charred and burned piece of wood out of the fire and do something beautiful and creative with it. That's really the image that's held out before us here. It's an image of hope. It's been plucked out of the fire, not just for a game, not just to show, look what I can take out the fire, no, but it's look what I'm going to do with what's come out of the fire. What you thought was finished, what you thought was just about to turn to ashes and to be blown to the ends of the earth, look what I'm going to do with it. I've plucked it out, and however hopeless it looks, I've got great hopes. And Christian, if this is you tonight, if you've fallen into serious sin, you've been chastised, you might feel like that piece of wood in the fire, just useless, that people just bury in the ground. And the Lord is holding you tonight, saying, no, I've stopped you going to ashes. I'm holding you in my hand, and I'm showing you to the world, and I'm showing you to the devil. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire? And there's a smile on his face. There's joy in his heart at his recreative, restoring work. Hear it by faith, even said of you, a brand plucked from the fire for restoration. This is a master craftsman at work who can take the worst piece of wood and make it beautiful again. Make it useful, as we'll see. Because he says, fourthly, I'm cleansing him. He's verse 3, clothed with filthy garments, standing before the angel. Can you imagine that? What that must have been like? You know, maybe you've been working out in the yard, or you're doing a dirty job somewhere, and that's fine when you're with other people who are similarly caked in mud and grease. But maybe you end up sitting beside somebody or meeting somebody who's all dressed up in a suit or expensive clothes, you kind of feel incredibly dirty then, don't you? You kind of want to get away. And here's Joshua. He's clothed with filthy garments before the angel of God. This is extremely uncomfortable. Can you imagine what the words must have sounded like when he heard, "Take away the filthy garments. Take away the filthy garments." Joshua couldn't take them off. It's beyond him. But here, when God speaks, "Strip them off. Take away the filthy garments." And unto him he said, as he did this, "Behold," he's saying, "inspect yourself, Joshua. Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee." What refreshing, what re-energizing, what liberty must have been felt with this dirt, this filth, this waste being washed away. And the picture it was of his sins, the nation's, yours. This is what happens when God restores his people and when he saves a sinner for the first time as well. Because this isn't just an image that's true of God's people being restored to grace, but of sinners coming to grace for the first time. There's nothing like it when you get a handle on this. When you grasp this for your own soul, you're not left with a stitch of filth. It's all gone. "Behold," he says, "inspect, look. Look at your record," in other words. "Look at all you've done and been. Search it out. Can you find a sin?" No, he's saying, "I've caused your sin to pass from you. I've cleansed you. I've washed you." Then he says, fifthly, "and I'm clothing you." Doesn't just wash away the sin. He brings new clothes. "I will clothe thee with change of raiment." And it's literally festal garments. Royal robes. These are beautiful clothes that he's being dressed with again. It's not just take away the filth and put a plain, everyday, cheap, colorless garment on. No, he's saying, make him beautiful. Make him glorious. Give him garments that are associated with joy and festivity and celebration. And more than that, it's not just I'm clothing him, but I'm crowning him. I'm crowning him. But this is an interesting thing. Notice who initiates the crowning. It's Zechariah. Zechariah interrupts this monologue of the Lord as he's restoring this child of God. He's saying, "I've chosen him, I'm protecting him, I'm restoring him, I'm cleansing him, I'm clothing him." And Zechariah is getting so caught up with this scene, with the movement of this narrative, with the awesome monologue that's going on here, that eventually he erupts himself. It's almost as if he can't help it. And put a crown on his head. And I said, "Let them set a fair mitre on his head." And he may have wondered, what have I just said? But what happens? They set a fair mitre on his head and clothed him with the garments, and the angel of God stood by, approving, the master of all the ceremonies, even accepting this contribution of Zechariah. And it's like Zechariah is just saying, top it all off. Make it unmistakable what you've done for this child of God. Let there be no doubt left in anybody's mind as to his status and his spiritual condition. Great, yes, you're protecting him and you've chosen him and you're cleansing him and you're clothing him, but oh, that you would also crown him. That beautiful tiara would be upon his head, showing him once again to be a son of a king. And God approves and God delights and sets a stamp of approval upon it. It's like, yes, let him look clean for sure, but let him also look great. Let him look great and let him feel great. Let him enjoy the greatness of this salvation. So that wherever he looks on himself, top to toe, he sees that through Christ, God restores his fallen and chastised people to a sense of his love, to beauty, and to usefulness again. Because that's where he's left now. He's clothed and he's ready for service. He's equipped and ready to go out in the service of the Lord. Again, in his representative work for his people. You can read on in the chapter and see what happens next. But what he did for Joshua, believer, he can do for you. He can restore you. No matter how deep you've fallen, no matter how muddy the pit, no matter how severely you've been chastised, no matter how ferocious, hateful, and malicious the accusations, here is a prospect for you. God can restore you, and he's willing to. Why is this here? It's to encourage the whole nation of Israel, still in their pit of misery. There's a great future ahead. Whatever sin you've committed, however many sins you've committed, however deep, however high, however wide and long they've gone on, here is a great picture for you to rest on and be comforted by. Yes, even you can be restored. Restored to a sense of God's love so that you can be like Joshua. Not just crawling home, limping all the way, hesitating and doubting. No, but absolutely and totally assured of his forgiveness and his acceptance and his delight and his joy in you. And unbeliever, God can do this for you too. This is not just about renewal. This is about a brand new work as well. Yes, this picture would have greatly encouraged the believers in Israel, but also the unbelievers too. And it's all through Christ. The angel of God is the one we have to remember above all here. The messenger of God. The Son of God. He is the one who we are to go home with. Not Joshua so much. Or the devil, certainly not, but the angel of God. He's the one that accomplishes this. He begins it, he ends it. He is the beginning and the end, the author and finisher of faith. Seek him, believe him. Look what can be accomplished through him. What can be yours if you are his? Is this not tempting? Is this not alluring? Is this not desirable? Go home. Wearing a crown. Or with filthy garments. Let's pray. Great and gracious God of wonderful restoration, how many times we need Zechariah 3 in our lives. Maybe every day, almost at times we feel. But if we need it every day, do it every day. Help us not to ever think that there are too many days where we need Zechariah 3. Lord, renew and restore thy fallen and chastised people, that they may feel thy love again, that they may feel the beauty thou hast put upon them, and that they may feel and be useful in thy service. and draw in those who have never tasted an atom of this. May they desire it, and desire it, and desire it, and ask for it, and ask for it, and ask for it, until thy promise is fulfilled, that he who knocks, the door will be opened. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.